some historical perspectives on green revolutions, and then at the end of the talk, indicate some of the issues that I think this historical perspective may indicate about looking at the future. Now, the equation I'm going to come to several times through this talk is this one, and this shows you that yield is equal to the amount of nitrogen accumulated, the total amount of nitrogen accumulated by the crop, times the nitrogen harvest index, that is the amount that ends up in the seed, divided by the nitrogen seed fraction, percent protein, essentially, of the seed. This equation defines maximum yield, and I think many people have forgotten this, that you cannot have any more yield than the nitrogen that crop accumulates. If you're going to harvest the grain, the key thing in limiting yield often is the nitrogen. So this is a background that I'm going to use for throughout this talk. The real green revolution, the first green revolution, happened about 5,000 years ago in Sumeria. Without this green revolution, we wouldn't be here. This is when people started to do agriculture. And at that time, civilization and agriculture was synonymous. You had to learn to develop a system of writing and reading to do the agriculture. And to organize people to grow the crops, you had to have a hierarchical society which organized the things. The Sumerians were the first to do this in what people refer to the Mesopotamian Valley. And one of the motivators is the need to produce wheat and barley, and one of the major reasons is to produce beer. And here's a depiction of the Sumerians drinking beer. They used straws, interestingly enough. They didn't, after they fermented the grain, they didn't filter it, so the top is this chaff floating on. The bottom was a particulate matter, so they drank their beer through straws. And they were pretty well famous in history of liking their beer. The Sumerians developed in the southern part of what is now Iraq. It's often referred to the Tigris-Euphrates area. The Tigris wasn't involved in this at all, really. As it turned out, as you can see on the right, the Tigris emanated mainly from the Zagros Mountains in the winter rains. Because it was close by, it cut a deep channel. And by the time they would want to irrigate to sow the crop in the following fall, the water had receded in the river and had been very difficult to irrigate out of the Tigris. So they irrigated from the Euphrates, which originated from the Taurus Mountains, which now is in Turkey. The river flowed through the Iraq, and through this period, a lot of water evaporated. By the time it got to southern reaches of the Euphrates, the river was flowing pretty slowly. There were silt deposits that raised the level of the river, and it was pretty well at the level of the land surface, if not higher in some cases or sometimes. And so it was easy to cut channels in the riverbank, put the water in the canals, and feed the people, or feed the fields around that. And these are the city-states that developed. Now, the end of the society, this lasted for more than 1,000 years. As you can imagine, they were irrigating over this whole period, the salinity developed because the river was so high there wasn't any backflush of the water or the salt, and so salinity developed, and eventually the folks had to move further north. They bumped into the Akkadians, who didn't appreciate this intrusion and were defeated, and that was the end of the Sumerians. The southern parts of Iraq where the salt was accumulated, or the salt marshes where the insurgents would escape because it was so hard to track them into these salt marshes. So the remnants of the Sumerian are still with us. Why did the Sumerians have success? Their average yields were, according to archaeology, at least about 1.8 tons per hectare. And they used the river for water, but it turns out an important resource was nitrogen. And we can calculate out about how much nitrogen they must have had on their fields. The yield of 1,800 grams per meter squared times, I'm using a seed fraction of 0.022, and we'll assume a harvest index of 0.6. They had a pretty highly productive system. So we can calculate out that the river had to give them about 66 kilos per hectare per year. This is a substantial amount of nitrogen. Organic matter from the north had to be deposited on the field. So they were dependent on this additional nitrogen that had to be provided to their fields. We'll go forward in history to the Greeks, Romans, and Europeans. They too were interested in beer, as this depicts, but they were in a mode where they didn't have the rivers to provide the nitrogen. And they ended up with a system where they put the land in fallow, a two-field or three-field rotation, and their main crops again were barley and wheat. That's what you could make bread and beer from. And they would have fallow between this period, these crops. So they were really only farming a half, or maybe in this case, maybe two-thirds of their land, and they had the fallow period to regenerate the nitrogen. The yields at this were probably no more than about 0.8 of a ton per hectare. We put it into our equation and we calculate out that they were probably getting about 35 kilos per hectare. This is about the annual input you could expect from atmospheric sources and from symbiotic fixation. So that by the fallow system, they were getting enough nitrogen to do that, but they couldn't get any higher yields. They had no other management practices given higher yields. So throughout history, this was a long time, starting with the Greeks, through the Middle Ages, yields were at this 0.8 level. The second major green revolution actually happened in Great Britain, starting about 1700. Again, they were interested in particularly in wheat and barley to make beer. And this green revolution started actually in the Netherlands. The Dutch had decided in their golden age that one of the key products for them would be cheeses. And so they developed a system to feed dairy cows. They had a rotation scheme where they had several summers of pasture, which included a clover. And the British visitors noticed that the wheat yields were very high following that clover pasture system. And the British introduced this system. It's called the four-field Norfolk rotation. We had, as you see, we'll go through field one, the clover ryegrass for at least 2 years, sometimes three or four. Then the pasture would be plowed. They put in wheat. This would be followed by barley and oats, turnips, and then barley or oats again. One of the important things is this rotation now provided oats and turnips to feed particularly horses. So for one of the first times in history, muscle power from humans did not do the work, all the work. They now could put in horses. And as a result, you needed fewer people to do the cropping. The other important aspect of this is it doubled yield. The yield went to at least 2 tons per hectare. So this Green Revolution II was a doubling over what had been ahead of that. So that we had a system now, an agricultural system, cropping system, which needed fewer people and doubled yield. So the cities, or so people were now released from agriculture for the first time in history, and this is really the basis of the Green Revolution. So this Green Revolution, this 2.0, had one of the more profound effects in history. We calculate out how much nitrogen had to be gotten from this rotation, and using the same equation, we come up with 73 kilos per hectare. So we can look to the legumes to provide this amount of nitrogen in this rotation scheme. Well, we're coming to what I'm going to call Green Revolution 3.0. Society's changed, so Americans, in this case my example, aren't nearly as dependent on beer, but some folks still enjoy it, I hear. And so that we do have a basis for crop production, and this revolution, again, had a profound effect on society. The basis of this was really the manufacture of nitrate fertilizer. The process is to take atmospheric ammonia or nitrogen, put it with hydrogen, and make ammonia, and ammonia could be made in nitrate. Fritz Haber developed this process in the early 1900s. He was awarded the 1918 Nobel Prize for that. Carl Bosch developed the system for industrialization, and he got the hydrogen source from methane and then made the industrial plant for this. BASF Corporation was the one that was identified to make this, and this was particularly important in Germany. Bosch was working in Germany because the political pressures, military pressures were building. Germany could only import the nitrates. They had no domestic source. Now they had a way to manufacture their nitrate. And this was a key basis then for their ability to wage World War I. And one of the real prizes after World War I for the Americans and British were to get into that BASF plant and discover how it was done. And as a result, then, munitions plant went up all around the world, and then we had World War II. So we had all these plants making nitrates, and as you know, the terrorists have found nitrate very useful as a munition in their activities. After the end of World War II, you had all these plants that could produce nitrate and no war going on. So the nitrate was now released for fertilization. And this is what happened worldwide, or many places in the world. This illustrates what's done in the U.S. maize. On the right-hand ordinate is the nitrogen application in fields in the U.S. on maize. The solid line at the bottom is the actual nitrogen amount. The left-hand ordinate is the yield in tons per hectare of maize, and the abscissa is the year. Now, I've started this at 1950, shortly after World War II, when essentially fertilization was extremely low. And you can see the origin there is 2 tons per hectare, exactly the yield that people have been getting since the Norfolk rotation. And now we could apply nitrates, and you see that we had a rapid linear increase in yields, 0.17 tons per hectare per yield. This continued till about 1970, and people do regressions quite different than I do. If you start in 1950, it's clear there was a break in about 1970 in this yield increase, and we went to a very lower yield increase rate. Nitrogen levels had leveled off. Farmers had discovered diminishing returns for the investment in nitrogen, and it flattened off. So we have a coincidence here of the change in yield with this nitrogen application. The reason the yield continued to increase are probably two. First, the management of our farmlands was consolidated into the hands of the best farmers. And so I think this gave us better nitrogen management. And secondly, through this period, remember that nitrogen fraction to grain was pretty important in what yield you could get? It dropped. And it was taken from about 0.15 down to 0.13 or 0.12. So much of the yield increase can be accounted for this. In a little trajectory into the future, we could take this. It certainly doesn't go on the exponential increase that some people claim. And in fact, in realistic assessment of other resource limitations, you'll see we have a ceiling out there that we're going to bump into within about 20 years. So I expect another break out there, and this will be at something around 11 or 12 tons. And I'm going to talk about that a bit more at another session tomorrow. But I think we're going to be bumping into that. Now, fortunately, I'm going to be gone when I'm predicting that bump will be here, so nobody can claim I was wrong. But I think the evidence is pretty strong. We're headed for that zone. So what the next green revolution, which the meeting assumes is one, is I'm really going to call it 3.1. It's simply an extension of what had been going on in industrialized countries, extending it to Mexico, India, and Southeast Asia, and particularly apply it to the crops of wheat and rice. There were key breeding activities that went on. There were short stems to support the heavy panicles. There was an increase in nitrogen harvest index. Most people focus on harvest index, but the real key was nitrogen harvest index. You got a lot more nitrogen stored in that plant. And you had a crop that could store nitrogen, vegetative material, take it up early in the season, and have it available later for the grains. And one aspect of this was getting a more erect leaves. Here's a results that John Jahee and I calculated a few years ago, where we looked at leaf angle as it relates to the leaf area index. The leaves at the bottom of the canopy are not parasitic. If they don't get an influx of a little bit of light now and then, they senesce and die. So they need a little bit of light just to persevere until the nitrogen was being transported to the grain. And we can calculate out the right relationship about how high a leaf air index you can carry based on the leaf angle. So if you increase the leaf angle from about 45 degrees up to 60 degrees, you could have a substantially greater leaf air index. And the key was then you had a very nice storage reservoir for that nitrogen. And the yield, which is on the top abscissa, could be raised because of that. There were important management practices along with the breeding efforts. There was greater plant density. Greater plant density meant you had more material to take up the nitrogen from the soil, and you had, more importantly, storage reservoirs for that nitrogen, that it's available when the seed started growing, and there were increased nitrogen applications. Norman Borlaug, in fact, wrote when he is dealing with the Green Revolution that chemical fertilizer is really the fuel that powered the Green Revolution's forward thrust. This is the basis of Green Revolution 3.1. What seems to me a real theme in all these past Green Revolutions, starting with one, is the nitrogen story. What was the nitrogen resource for these crops? And when I look forward to the future, and of course the following speaker is going to deal with this in much greater depth, when I look to the future, I think the nitrogen has to be an important component. Using the equation I've used previously, you can see what the maximum yield is plotted on the ordinate against the amount of nitrogen taken up. If you don't take up the nitrogen, you can't possibly increase the yield. I don't care how good your molecular genetics is. The key is getting the nitrogen, getting it stored in the plant, and then providing it to the grain when it develops. I'm going to put some suggestions for consideration. One for the developing regions where we have to be focused on yield. I think we have to figure out how to get more nitrogen input on the fields, one way or the other. Secondly, I'm going to suggest I think legumes have to be an important part of cropping systems, and I think they have to be economically valuable. The problem is there have been efforts to get legumes, but they're not an economic return. The macuna would produce nitrogen, but the farmers didn't like it because they didn't have any economic return. If you go to grain legumes, the emphasis is often on the grain yield. It may be that we have to strike a compromise where we settle for a little bit more less yield, but leave more nitrogen in the plant to be used in the soil. Anyway, I think legumes have to be a part of future cropping systems. We have to maximize recovery of soil nitrogen. There's just a lot of nitrogen that's lost in the soil in this process. And finally, I'm putting question marks on socioeconomic structures because I'm arguing we have to invest a lot in this chain. We have to invest in the fertilizer plants, transportation system, and the farmers have to have credits to buy this fertilizer and expect a return from that. So we need a stable socioeconomic structure to make this, to make a yield increase work, it seems to me. Another part of Green Revolution 4 is the greening. This is emphasizing that we change our environmental practices, which would happen in industrialized regions. The first one is we again look at minimizing the applied nitrogen losses, denitrification and leaching. This is where we're losing most of our nitrogen when it's applied. Again, I'm going to suggest we have to look at increasing the legumes in our cropping systems. Somehow that we become a little bit less dependent on the application of the nitrogen fertilizer. The second one is, can we increase the storage of nitrogen or vegetative growth in the plant? Nitrate is not very conducive to plant activity. It can be poisonous. So one challenge is, can we store more? The stems are untouched in crops. For instance, can we get stems of plants that will store more nitrogen, and then when the seeds start growing, translocate that to the seed? I think this is an important area for future research. Another possibility is extend soil nitrogen uptake through seed growth. Many crops greatly decrease in that soil uptake at seed growth or stop it altogether. There's some evidence that some of the advances in yield have been because we've extended nitrogen uptake in the seed growth, and I think this deserves more study because of the trade-off between supporting seeds and supporting nitrogen uptake. And finally, is one that's not a politically correct recommendation, but I think I would like to say it, is I put jaundiced production of, or judicious production of bioenergy. Sorry, I exposed my two thoughts. If you're going to increase mass yield, you've got to have nitrogen. Everything tells us that. You can do the calculations. And if you only get 30 or 40% recovery in nitrogen, to do some of the estimates of bioenergy that people have assumed, we're going to introduce huge amounts of nitrogen in the environment. And I think this is against the idea of really what bioenergy is about, and certainly the greening of the future. So I have a very substantial concern about the energy crops. Well, I don't want to leave the podium. Let me summarize. First, I think that the history has been fairly clear, if we go far from the beginning, that major changes in society have been associated with major changes in cropping. That we have, and this goes back to the first Green Revolution, we wouldn't have society, wouldn't have civilization without the cropping, and a key part of that was the nitrogen input. The Green Revolution II in Great Britain led to the industrialized society because of the advance in yield. And then Green what I'm calling Green Revolution 3, allowed the whole structure of society change because so few people were needed to produce agriculture. And we are now faced with some serious challenges how to extend this revolution into the next stage. And I'm hoping that following speakers will address some of those issues. I don't want to leave the stage without a little bit of advertisement. Ken's already alluded to this. My wife and I have just published a book called Bread, Beer, and the Seeds of Change, Agricultural Imprint on History. Some of the things I've been talking about are in the book, and what we point out is bread and beer is what most people consumed until very recent times, and this had a huge impact on the course of history. Your ability to grow crops influenced history is probably about as much as any other single factor. So we had a lot of fun writing. We'd be happy to talk with you about it. If you want, we're going to be at the CAB booth this afternoon from 2 or 4. And we're supposed to have some beer bread there. So if you want a taste treat, we'll have some beer bread to share with you. Thank you very much.
So we want to thank Tom because he followed the format we hope to follow for the rest of the symposia. That is 25 minutes of a presentation followed by 5 minutes of questions. So we're in the 5 minute of question. We actually have 7. So I'll entertain questions for the audience. Yes, please.
We know that 1, 2, and 3 were based on only the above ground part of the plan.
The question had to do with the earlier Green Revolutions never took a look at the roots, and do we need to do that in Green Revolution 4? Well, I expect that's the case. If you're looking at nitrogen recovery, we usually had plenty of roots for nitrogen recovery, unless you're at depth. And then now the question is, do we need greater root density at depth to recover some of this nitrate that may be seeping further? That's certainly important. And the other question is, can we store any nitrogen in these roots? The roots aren't geared really for nitrogen storage, but maybe it could be. So I don't want to close out that we shouldn't look at roots. I didn't mean to, at least.
If you do so. Next question. Yes, J.K.
You talked about nitrogen, but I missed the discussion of photosynthesis. And I saw your one graph. You had a relationship of nitrogen uptake and yield, where rice was showing higher influential than hay. So is photosynthesis not going to be limited for rice, or what is the assumption there?
I think historically we don't have much evidence rice has been the limiting factor, other than nitrogen to give you the rubisco and other photosynthetic materials. So when you harvest the grain, you think of starch, but the limiting factor is how much nitrogen you have to build that protein. That's the historical message in my thing. So we don't have a great deal of evidence, I think, that photosynthesis is limiting. And tomorrow I'll be talking a little bit more about that. And I think maybe some of the following speakers will also.
Question here. Jim?
As yields move higher, the nitrogen content tends to go lower, particularly in dynamic series, for example, but also in North Central GSA, but the same thing happening. So I think you can comment about that.
Jim was making the comment that in recent times the nitrogen content of seeds have dropped. As we get higher yields, and of course this is consistent with the argument or the equation I'm showing you, that you can get higher yields by having lower nitrogen. The problem is many of our grains are dependent on nitrogen content. Wheat, for instance, you've got to have that usually a minimum protein content to make it a viable crop. The same, in some cases, the taste in rice is dependent on protein content. So I don't know how much more area we have to exploit on that one.
Other questions? Okay, Tice, then John.
Tice? Again, Tom, you make the point of nitrogen is important, and I don't think anybody will dispute that. But I thought what they might dispute, and I dispute, is that nitrogen is driving the improvement. And I just want to give you one example, and I use your own figure, showing corn production over the last 60 years. and show that nitrogen input has not changed since 1970. But yields have increased by about 50-75% of that year. So how do you explain that?
Well, I hoped I did during the talk.
So the question, repeat the question.
Okay, it was more a comment that Tice is pointing out that we've had increased yields without increasing nitrogen. How do we explain that? One thing is, at least in the U.S., the crop is being grown in by fewer farmers who obviously are the best managers. So I think we're getting more return on the fertilizer in terms of the grain. The other one thing which you've pointed out is that we have lower nitrogen content in these grains, which would contribute a substantial amount of this. The other thing, which again is that we may have been extending nitrogen uptake into grain filling by the way we apply it. So I think we have better management of nitrogen.
But also the implication was that yields, the prediction here by Tom, that corn yields in the U.S. are going to start stagnating because of this nitrogen constraint. Yep.
I don't agree.
Well, and that's why they put us in the basement, Tyson. John.
Heard the comment. The comment was we can learn as much from our failures as a success, and obviously this talk may have been a failure, so I hope you learned something from it.